Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Ruthless Miliband shuffles his pack. Murphy, Byrne, Twigg and Abbott are all out or demoted, whereas Prime Minister Cameron redistributes only the smaller red boxes. What do this week's reshuffles tell us about the battle lines in the run-up to 2015? Also this week, press regulation is back on the agenda and back in the long grass. The Privy Council rejects the newspaper's version of self-regulation and looks set to recommend the politician's royal charter instead. But will any of the editors actually sign up in the end? And as the leader of the ultra-nationalist English Defence League resigns, we look at the latest hammer blow to far-right politics in Britain. Joining me for all of this, we have The Observer's political editor, Toby Helm, The Guardian's political diarist, Hugh Muir, and political blogger, Hopi Sen. A warm welcome to you all. Now, for David Cameron, it was a reshuffle to bring in a few more female faces and more MPs from the north of England, a night of the long drives, as one wag had it. For Ed Miliband, though, it was the latest example of a ruthless streak. Out went Stephen Twigg from education, Liam, no more money left, Byrne from work and pensions, and a demotion too for Jim Murphy. He goes from defence to development. Meanwhile, the big winners of the day were Rachel Reeves, Tristram Hunt and Vernon Coker. Hopi Sen, I think they were fairly frenetically telling anyone who would listen that this was not a purge of the Blairites. Does that mean it was a purge of the Blairites?
I think it was not intended to be a purge of the Blairites. I think it was an unfortunate consequence of the way that the only people who appeared to be demoted on the first day were from the right of the party, that became a dominant narrative. I think it's a bit unfair on Ed Miliband to say that, because if you look at the people he's promoted, like Tristram Hunt, like Gloria DiPiero, like Liz Kendall over the years, there's been quite a balanced range of promotions inside the Labour Party. However, I think what it is a purge of those who have expressed any sense of disloyalty with the leader's strategy, especially coming from a position of relative equality. There are those who've been promoted who, you know, will sometimes say to you quietly, oh, well, I'm not quite sure about this or that. But there are those who, at the more senior level, would say it a little bit more loudly into more significant figures in the media. And I think they've been punished quite severely for that.
And do you think, Toby, with Jim Murphy in particular, you got the impression he wasn't happy with where things ended up on Syria? Do you think that's what this was about?
Yeah, and he's not happy now. I had two conversations with people yesterday, and he's clearly very, very unhappy about it. The thing about Jim Murphy is he has been quite a vocal Blairite behind the scenes, but in recent times he's been scrupulously loyal to Miliband, and I actually think this one's a mistake, because I think Ed has slightly misjudged this. He had gone out of his way to actually get behind him, but clearly there had been a disagreement about Syria. I don't know what happened in that disagreement. Probably that only the two of them do, but clearly something has run deep, or Ed's made a mistake, one of those two.
But didn't he sound, after the event, after the government was defeated, he was on the radio, I think, sort of saying, oh, well, obviously we don't want to rule anything out and all options.
Yeah, but that depends how you... I mean, there's so many different ways of playing that whole issue, wasn't it? You could remain loyal by just striking a slightly different tone. I mean, and also it was an issue in which you were kind of semi-authorised to have slightly different opinions, I think.
Right.
But I think in the broader thrust of things, Murphy had silenced himself, and he'd been a good boy, and I think that's why he's very angry, and I think that's the one really dangerous thing for Ed Miliband in this reshuffle.
And do you think there's any chance that this might mean we're looking again at Trident, where Jim Murphy was fairly gung-ho?
I doubt it.
Which I think is really interesting, because if you talk to people around Diane Abbott, she will say much the same thing, or that, you know,
the surprise was that she felt she'd been relatively loyal. If you thought about all of the trouble she might have made, she hasn't really made any of it. And so people were saying, well, given that, what did he expect? Did he expect her to be any more loyal than she was?
She went on the radio and said she would resign if he did go along with bombing Syria.
Well, I think it's all relative, isn't it? And a lot of people looked at her and thought, oh my God, this is going to be a complete disaster. But I think that within the parameters with which someone like that would work, I think the feeling was that she had been fairly disciplined. And was that phrase that apparently was used, or she used to describe her conversation, that I think Ed wants a bit more message discipline. And that does seem to be the tone of the entire reshuffle, doesn't it? I mean, here you have a party in Ed's image, if you like, now. And I was very taken with what Raphael Baer was writing in The Staggers in New Statesman, and he said this isn't really about the Blairites or about the Brownites. This is now the Milibandites. This is his party. And that's interesting in that he's almost been in the situation in recent, since he took over, really, of being the Labour Party leading him into government rather than him leading the Labour Party into government. So what does that then do if he now fashions the party in his own image, because all the evidence is the public haven't much liked his own image.
But he's come up with some of these slogans, hasn't he? You know, the predatory capitalism and stuff, Hopi, that sometimes baffle the lobby on the day and look maybe a bit smarter a couple of months down the line. But what he's not been so good at is persuading the shadow cabinet to develop these into policy. So, do you think now he's got, if he's right and he's now got his own team, we might see a bit more of that?
I think sometimes you get a sense of a degree of frustration that you're landed with a large slogan and then no money or authority to deliver what might lie behind that slogan. So, for instance, take the minimum wage or the welfare cap. Each of those sounds quite like big policies, but when you dive into the detail of them, they're actually pretty sort of minor amendments to existing processes or systems. So we weren't able to, for example, announce an increase to the minimum wage or any significant level of attachment to the living wage. And the same thing for what's in the structural welfare cap, what's in, what's out. But one of the points I thought was interesting about what Hugh said is that the way Diane took her sacking was very, very different and much more positive than the way that people on my side of the party responded to kind of a slight shuffling of the decks. There's a confidence that says, well, if you don't like what I say and you don't like kind of my political position, fine, I don't need to be in the shadow cabinet. I don't need to be a junior minister. I can go out and make my case and be happy about that. And one of the interesting things for the people on the right of the party, and in some senses this is a good thing because it's loyal and it's message discipline, it's all the things that we've been talking about, is that they've not really been willing to say, right, that's if I sufficiently don't agree with this, I'm going to take my ball home. And if you're not prepared to do that in the end, it's going to put you in a weak negotiating position because, you know, at some point, if you really think that the direction of the travel is wrong, you need to be able to say, actually, I don't mind not being part of this. And the Blairites, as currently constituted, have never been able to say that.
Do you think we might look back in, I don't know, a few years' time and see this as a moment where the right of the Labour Party was really on the way down for the first time since probably the mid-80s?
I actually doubt that because, as Hopi was saying, you know, the so-called Blairites who've been shafted have been replaced by other Blairites. I think it's more subtle than that. I think it's the old Blairites who've been, in a sense, replaced by the new Blairites. But I mean, clearly in policy...
We're still using this Blairite word, aren't we?
Yes, because we can't get away from it. But I think in policy terms, yes, but I think those policies are largely endorsed by the new brigade. I think what will be really interesting is what Tristram Hunt comes up with on education. I think that's the really, really interesting question.
I mean, he's in some sense a historian, sort of telegenic bloke, Gove-like to that extent.
Yeah.
We don't know.
I think on free schools, what are they going to do about free schools?
Well, what's their policy? I mean,
Twigg was actually, frankly, quite all over the place on free schools. He was personally quite in favour, and yet he was sort of instructed to be against. But now you've got this several stories developing about this teacher, head teacher who was unqualified, who resigned after 6 months today, this preschool in Derby. You know, there's a possibility, potential for Labour to really to get stuck into that. And I suspect what they'll say is, yes, good free schools we like, but we'll make sure they're A, in the right places, and B, the kids in them are taught by properly trained teachers. I think that's where they'll go.
There does seem to be a logic to what's happening, though, in that at conference, many of us were struck by just how much policy there was, having said that this is a policy-light party for so long. And now, not long after conference, and having had quite a good conference, he seems to be seizing the reins of the party a lot more. And I wonder how much of it was on the flowchart, how much of it this was planned, that, you know, we'd say nothing very much for a period of time.
As long as we can get away with.
And then, right, maybe that's what all that pre-distribution stuff was about. Maybe it was a way of saying things without actually saying anything.
Yeah, I think he had to do the striking stuff on policy, and he did that at conference. And one other thing he hadn't done is big personnel axe-wielding, and he's done a bit of that now.
So, yeah, finally on this.
There's one other interesting side, which is away from the kind of frontline personnel, there's been a big shift in the backroom personnel in Labour. And that's really been much more about a reuniting of the old 2007 backroom Labour staff. Spencer Livermore, Michael Duggar, Jonathan Ashworth, a whole bunch of people from the kind of early Gordon Brown operation, set up in a way that exploits the tensions that existed from them afterwards. So you've got Michael Duggar on one side and Douglas Alexander on another, running different elements of the Labour Party general election campaign. If the party's doing well, that will work in a very supportive manner. If things start going badly, I expect you'll start seeing little pops from either side at each other from that. And it'll be very interesting to see how that power imbalance in terms of who's running the Labour general election campaign and what messages get prioritised plays out next year.
We know these are people who aren't necessarily bad at faction fighting, you mean?
There is one thing that we don't know that we must know, and it's, did Liam Byrne leave his successor a note?
What did he
There's
say?
No policy.
There's no job left. Let's talk about the other side of the aisle then. Fairly small beans, really, wasn't it, from the Conservatives? Is that a sign of confidence, Hugh, or a sign of complacency on Cameron's part?
Again, I think it's positioning. I think the hand of Lord Ashcroft was across it in some ways, in that, you know, there seemed to be three strands to it. Let's promote more women, let's promote more people from the north, and dealing with those deficiencies there. And also, minorities did very well out of it. Think about Helen Grant, Sam Gimo gone to the Whip's office. I think that there was a conscious effort to say, look, we are different and you can get on. And of course, the whole theory is that the people who've been promoted this time may well be into the cabinet next time. And of course, the Tory party have this ringing in their ears, which tells them they've got to be seen to do better with those target groups, with women, with the North and with minorities. And so, to some extent, he's tried to address that a bit.
But it's noble stuff, but in too small a scale. I mean, even if Hugh's right in this means that the cabinet might look more varied than it does in the event of a Cameron win after 2015. It's not going to make much odds to how the party looks to the public before then, is it?
Very little. I think two things struck me about it. One is how many young, ambitious Tories are left with nothing. You know, there's people who spend their lives basically dreaming up loyal questions for Prime Minister's questions, like Charlie Elphick and Chris Skidmore, I can name about 20 of them, who seem to have come off with nothing. And they will be added to the list of very, very discontented young people who've come into Parliament expecting it to be a great career. The other thing I think is really interesting about the Tory, I mean, it's just the way the Tory reshuffle was perceived, and it takes us back to the Brown Blair years, but it's the way the media is beginning to see things through, kind of Osborne gets his men in position, Sajid Javid and Matt Hancock and Claire Perry and all these people coming through. So we're beginning to see it in terms of the future, and I think that's an interest. But I agree with you completely. I think what it means to the public is zilch.
I assume at the back of their mind is that they're going to have a cabinet reshuffle next year, and they want to have people who are kind of Minister of State level tested that they can then promote into that with a big change of faces next year.
Possibly. I wonder whether they will, though.
Nick Clegg was a bit less reticent, wasn't he? I mean, so he made the one cabinet change, booting out the Scottish Secretary.
I find it frankly astonishing that, I mean, okay, it's four men sitting around here discussing it today, but frankly astonishing that nearly four years into the first time that Liberal Democrat Party have been in government for two generations, and they still haven't been able to put a woman in the cabinet. And I find that one of the most quietly astonishing things about British politics, that one of our major parties has not been able to put a woman at the top table.
My favourite fact about the Lib Dem reshuffle is that now of the three Liberal Democrat-run departments, two of them are run by people who wanted to abolish those departments, Vince Cable and Alistair Carmichael. But Hugh, more attention really has gone to the appointment of Norman Baker, who had some questions about the death of Dr. David Kelly, well, as a Home Office Minister.
That appointment and what happened in Scotland, it's almost for Nick Clegg, it's the kind of putting the lead in the pencil reshuffle. Because, you know, it's said that he wants something more robust in Scotland to take on Alex Salmond. And at the Home Office, I think he wants more differentiation. And Norman Baker will give him that. It's almost like those films about, you know, the kind of hitman coming out of retirement for one last job, because I don't think anyone expects Norman Baker to do anything thereafter. But between now and the election, he can cause Theresa May a deal of grief
and
allow Nick Clegg to say, look, we're different. We're not going along with all this stuff.
And did you see, Toby, the resignation letter of his predecessor, Jeremy Brown, which talked about welfare dependency and the importance of internationally competitive business rates. He sounded like he was going to join the Conservatives, didn't he?
Well, he is. He's right of most of the most of the left on the Conservative benches anyway. I mean, the
majority 3,700 or something. Do you think he'll swap?
Yeah, he's an
interesting
guy. Jeremy Brown, and was very close to Clegg, and I think was incredibly close. It's clearly something has happened there. And I would have loved to have seen that conversation between the two of them, because Jeremy Brown is not somebody who is short of expressing an opinion.
Let's leave reshuffles there and shuffle off to another issue. Lord Leveson has been doing the rounds of the Parliamentary Select Committee this week. His first Westminster appearance since his report into press ethics was published last year. And it comes in the week that the Privy Council turned up its collective nose at a charter proposed by the newspapers for their self-regulation. Hugh, newspapers' version gets the thumbs down. The politicians' version, if we can call it that, is looking like it's going to be endorsed by the Privy Council. But are any editors actually going to join up?
Doesn't look so. I mean, we at the Guardian, with the Financial Times, and the Independent aren't quite as hostile as some of the other papers. But we have our misgivings as well. And you know, this just looks like an almighty mess. If you chart its progress right from the very beginning, when Cameron decided to take a grip on this issue and he commissioned the Leveson inquiry, and then a formula for press regulation emerged from the Leveson inquiry, and then handed it over to the Culture Department, who were supposed to sort it all out. And you see the success of their efforts, where we are, where we look like we'll have the government's version, the Privy Council version, and then this independent regulator, perhaps, that will have the Times Group, Sun, and the Mail, and the Mirror in it. And,
so it's nobody's version, it's kind of there.
It's just an unholy mess. And so, you know, you do wonder whether down the road we'll end up in a worse position than we were before, which is pretty much an achievement, really, to have made this much of a hotspot.
So less effective regulation than the PCC?
Well, because you're going to have regulators who are unrecognised by anyone. And then you've got newspapers who are, or media organisations who may have their own regulator, but are also playing this Russian roulette, because it's not if their regulator is not registered and they go down on a big libel, then under the Leveson doctrine, they may all end up with aggravated damages from that.
I see.
And so
they'll claim it's illegal.
Well, I think that the Mail Group have made noises about saying that whole arrangement's illegal anyway, and they will go and they'll take it to Europe. I think Roger Alton was talking about using the Human Rights Act, and so it is a complete mess.
So Hugh's going to present a separate podcast which will go over some of this grisly detail on Media Talk, so people who are interested can pick
read
up.
All about it.
They'll hear all about it later. But Toby, I mean, we had this moment, didn't we, earlier in this year, these kind of now infamous pizzas with Oliver Letwin being in the room together with Hugh Grant and some Labour and Lib Dem people knocking together the politicians' version, which is now going through. Does it feel to you like the passing political consensus is going to be just that and going to disappear as everyone starts fighting again in artful ways this side of the election? Or do you think it's going to remain as politicians versus the press?
I think Hugh's right. I think it's a kind of incredible mess with the politicians dug in behind their charter.
Including the Conservatives.
Well, that's an interesting question. Cameron has to think very hard, doesn't he, about how the Cameron, or certainly conservative supporting press, reacts to him, and it all gets bound up with that. You know, certainly Miliband and the Lib Dems are sticking very firmly behind the charter. Cameron will try and fudge it, wary of the reaction of the likes of Paul Dacre if he backs the, you know, is seen to be muscling in behind the politicians' solution. So he'll be gently distancing himself from it, trying to play for time over a resolution. I mean, it's an unholy mess. It's much, much worse than before. And you're seeing it becoming a kind of battle, an extra battleground within the political game now. You know, the Mail is now today going for the Guardian in a big way, because presumably because the Guardian, partly because the Guardian, you know, the Guardian is more pro, you know,
this Leveson stuff.
The Leveson stuff, if you like, yes.
They could have had a Martha.
So, I mean, you've got a... It's an appalling situation. And they've got Leveson himself, who's so, obviously, so hacked off himself with the whole bloody thing, actually refusing to talk about his report in a Lords committee yesterday. I mean, what is going on?
Do you think it's a bit like...
the public make of it, I simply do not know. So good luck with your other podcast.
The most sort of introspective... moments in Labour history where the world stops listening. I mean, then, you know, last week all the newspapers were obsessed with what the Daily Mail was doing to Ed Miliband. This week the rest of the press are having a go at the Guardian because MI5 doesn't like the Guardian saying what MI5's been up to. And around the world, in this country, fewer and fewer people reading newspapers.
Fewer and fewer people reading newspapers, fewer and fewer people really caring, except in a general sense that you shouldn't tap phones and, you know, you shouldn't hack into the phones of murder victims. I don't think this is a burning issue outside of really, I don't know what the term for the media village is. I think very few people care about it, really. And I think increasingly less people care about newspapers, if I'm honest about it. The other
thing, politicians care less, though? Are they less scared than they were of the Kinnock treatment?
I think they can get away with more. I think there is also the sense of, however, that if you've got all the press on your side, that's a big benefit. But, you know, if there are two big blocks basically cancelling each other out, then you can, you know, play with that. But the thing I sort of feel is, A, quite taking the idea of duelling regulators, a competitive market in regulators that kind of everyone gets to choose which regulator they prefer. But this is not a good advert for government intervention in anything. It's really, you know, if you think kind of we're talking about regulation more generally, this is a mess. And then the second thing I think is, I kind of wish as much attention had been paid to the banking regulation debate.
Maybe they should choose their own regulator.
Well, exactly. I mean, if you applied the same kind of rules of the game and attention to things that are frankly for the British economy much more significant than this, then I think you would see a really different coverage. And frankly, I think the banking regulation and also the tax system debate has received much, much less attention compared to this. And I think that's a kind of challenge to the media as well, that, you know, I think even on the Miliband Mail story, 12% of people could recall it by the end of the week. Now, given how much attention it got, I would say, you know, that's probably symptomatic of a kind of separation of interest between the country and the communications industry.
The only thing I can think of, Hugh, where you've been able to sort of choose your own regulator, if you like, in the past, is the exam boards, where there's always those stories about dumbing down, isn't there? Because the exam boards are competing with each other to provide more.
Like that, doesn't it? Go like one big exam board. And so, you know, that idea is fairly discredited as well. I think there's a wider point to be made here, in that it's yet another lesson, and quite a salutary one, about the dangers of politicians speaking incautiously. And, you know, the dear Prime Minister does have a track record for this. And, he's got himself on this hook, because he's the one who said that no solution can work unless the victims sign off on it. And so, you know, he has so dramatically reduced his room for manoeuvre, and that's one of the reasons that why he's stuck between a rock and a hard place now.
Well, there's going to be plenty more on this, as you can imagine, and you'll be able to pick up Hugh's podcast, amongst other things, at theguardian.com/media. But now, finally, in what's been called a watershed moment for the far right, the English Defence League lost its leader this week. Tommy Robinson walked away from the anti-Muslim movement that he helped to found in 2009, citing disillusionment with street protests and worries about the extremist views of some members. Hugh, what do you think he thought he was doing for the last 3 or 4 years, then?
I think all the evidence points to quite a a confused individual, but I think that you do, you know, when you hear a story like this, you do have to go and get yourself a really large rock of salt rather than a pinch, because, you know, I think that this has come out of the blue. These are people who have no particular credibility. They have reasons to say what they're saying, and that, you know, their movement is crumbling before them anyway. Tommy Robinson, has been through, has got several convictions. He's looking at other charges as we speak. And so, you know, I think there are reasons for them to say, look, we've cleaned up our act. I'm not quite sure what the role of Quilliam is here, who are the, you know, the anti-extremist group who say they've facilitated all of this. But I think that one has to be very sceptical about Tommy Robinson, because he doesn't seem to be saying that he's renouncing any of the beliefs that he has. He just says that, you know, my group has been infiltrated by horrible people. Well, it was kind of created with a load of horrible people in it anyway. I'm surprised he's surprised.
So why is it that, you know, we do see some street protests like this? We saw the BNP at the last general election roughly doubling its vote, but doing so in a very ineffective way because they were all fighting like rats in a sack then. With right-wing populism on the rise in lots of countries, why is it not able, Hopi, in Britain to kind of coalesce? Is it just that Britain's too tolerant?
Well, I think to a certain extent there's a very competitive field for right-wing populism. I mean, if you're Nigel Farage, you'll look at the fracturing of the real extremists and think, this is brilliant for me because I can separate them out and say these are nothing to do with me and I'm opposed to all that sort of stuff, but then occupy the territory and concerns that they're talking about. So you can be anti-Islamism without appearing on the surface to be anti-Muslim, which is, I think, would be a fairly popular and populist political position. The other side of it is, I think, you know, never underestimate the ability of any organisation to appear to be run by its enemies. If you go on to Stormfront, which is I'm kind of very sad and I'm interested in this stuff, so not because I'm a white nationalist, just because I like to see what they're thinking, you will see constant accusations that the leadership of the BNP is skimming money. You will see constant accusations that they're run by MI5 agents. You will see constant accusations of total incompetence and, you know, disorganisation. I suspect at least one of those is true. And you'll see that, you know, these are small factions that are consumed by internal hatreds as much as they are by external hatreds. And that is always a very negative thing for any organisation. And thankfully, in this case, it helps to destroy them every time they get a bit closer to success.
So, I mean, paranoia is probably part of the draw for being involved in these outfits, Toby, isn't it? Which I guess then lends itself to infighting. But you do wonder why no one's achieved the success of a Marine Le Pen or something. Do you think it's because Nigel Farage is essentially picking up a lot of the malcontents, that the less mad malcontents, if you like?
Yeah, I think it is, and I think Hope is absolutely right. I saw this when I was in Germany. You'd see these far-right, individual new far-right organisations coming through. They'd reach a certain level of support and media attention, and then they would just internally combust because they were such a bunch of unpleasant people whose kind of raison d'etre is to be unpleasant. But yeah, I think had you not had UKIP now, you would have had a bigger force on the far right. You had it with the BNP sort of 4 or 5 years ago when Nick Griffin got into the European Parliament. And then Farage came through when he came back and, you know, and took them to a new level when he became leader again. And that takes off a certain sort of wing of people and they're left with only the nutters, basically, the nasties.
I think that it's difficult to assess why it never takes off, because those who are usually involved in these right-wing splinter groups are usually useless, and so it falls apart. And so you're never really able to say, is this because the British public doesn't accept this and wouldn't accept this as they have in other European countries, or is it just because those groups themselves were incompetent? I think, you know, we're going to find out about that at some point, because eventually someone's bound to come through who will run a competent party. But Radio 4 looked at this. There was a documentary a little while back, and the conclusion they reached was actually a lot of it's down to the genius of the Tory party and the main party system generally, because it's pretty flexible, and when it looks as if there's about to be a surge in, say, right-wing opinion, eventually the Tory party will react to that, because it draws from the Tory party. The Tory party is in the business of winning elections, pretty good at it, and eventually it changes itself and it soaks that up, And it almost cuts off the blood supply to the far right. You know, obviously there are extremes to which the Tory party will not go, but it will cut off just enough oxygen for far right groups not to be able to stand on their own feet.
And I think to support that point, if you look at what's happening in France at the moment, where the centre-right is doing incredibly badly and the socialists are also extremely unpopular, and you're seeing the Front National now in some polls actually in leading at 23-24% in the polls, you can see that if the centre-right fails and collapses in on itself, then that does leave that sort of space that was being identified. And if, you know, in this sense alone, I think it's very good that UKIP have been able to kind of take off the disappointed Tory vote, because, you know, definitely rather UKIP than anyone.
I think these parties need a broader political message, which is broader than just we hate Muslims or whatever. They need to be locking into the European debate, or a debate that is quite central to the kind of mainstream. I'm not saying sort of the whole issue of, you know, what the EDL are going on about isn't important, but it's not quite locked into the central core of political debate. It's a sort of we hate issue.
I think you really need respectability. I think, however you pitch it, even if you are an extreme right-wing party in Europe, I think one of the tricks they've had is that they've presented themselves in a respectable way. One of the reasons the EDL was never really going to work is because they always
look at Marine Le Pen. It's a big issue that's about Europe. It's about the future of Europe.
Okay, well, we better draw a line there before we give the far right too much practical advice on how to get their act together. From Guardian Towers. My thanks to Hopi, to Hugh, and to Toby. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.